December 13th, 2009. Henderson, Nevada. A security camera captures 30-year-old Stephen Kocher arriving in a residential neighborhood where he parks his car and is seen walking down the sidewalk before he vanishes without a trace. Earlier that day, Stephen had made a 135-mile trip to Henderson from his hometown of St. George, Utah, but never told anyone why. Since Stephen was struggling financially, it is theorized that he might have traveled to the area in order to seek employment or earn some money, but there is no conclusive evidence of what happened to him, and Stephen is never found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be exploring one of the more baffling missing persons cases of the modern era, the 2009 disappearance of Stephen Kocher. I have received numerous requests to cover this case, and since our podcast usually spends the month of December covering holiday-themed mysteries, I thought now would be a good time to do an episode. At the time Stephen Kocher went missing, he was preparing to spend the holidays with his family, and some Christmas gifts he had recently purchased were left behind in his abandoned car. Stephen was residing in St. George, Utah, and decided to make an unexplained trip to Henderson, Nevada, where he parked his car in an affluent retirement community and was captured walking away by a security camera before he inexplicably seemed to vanish into thin air. What makes this story even stranger is that in the days prior to his disappearance, Stephen would make some other unexplained road trips through Utah and Nevada before he returned home, and one of these trips was nearly 1,100 miles long. Since Stephen had been experiencing financial problems and had trouble securing full-time employment, due largely to the recession which was taking place in the United States at that time, there have been two primary theories to explain his actions. Either Stephen was feeling depressed or suicidal over a situation, causing him to experience some sort of mental break which prompted him to disappear voluntarily or take his own life. Or he became so desperate for money or employment that Stephen was roped into doing something which compelled him to make these lengthy trips, and he wound up becoming the victim of foul play. For the longest time, I found myself completely perplexed by this case, but in recent years, two forms of media have been produced that reveal previously undisclosed information which seemed to shed more light on what might have happened. One of them is a gentleman named Aaron Stoner, who has done a deep, multi-episode dive into the disappearance on his YouTube channel, and the other is a long-form podcast titled Eyes on Justice, which came out in 2021, and was produced by a team of private investigators who have done extensive work on this case. In fact, while I was working on this episode, the Eyes on Justice team participated in a news segment about Stephen's disappearance, and shared some pretty eye-opening new information. So on this episode, I'll start off by sharing the primary details about this case you'll find in most mainstream sources before I discuss these recent revelations. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. Also, I just wanted to mention that near the end of December, our podcast is going to be releasing another special Q&A episode. If you have a question you would like to hear answered on the show, please email it to me under the subject line Trail Went Cold Q&A to robin.warder@icloud.com. The deadline to send in questions is this coming Sunday, December the 11th. And speaking of this weekend, we're also holding one of our Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons this coming Saturday, December the 10th, in which I'll be screening classic episodes of Unsolved Mysteries, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. The live watch begins at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes or at the top of our social media pages. Hope to see you there. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Stephen Kocher. Our story begins in 2009, and our central figure is 30-year-old Stephen Kocher. Stephen was originally born in Amarillo, Texas, to parents Rolf and Deanne Kocher, and is the second of their five children. The Kocher family are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, aka the LDS Church, and Stephen is very devoted to Mormonism. Following his graduation from high school, Stephen would travel to Brazil to perform missionary work, and he would eventually earn a degree in communications from the University of Utah. By this point, the Kochers have relocated to Utah, and Rolf and Deanne live in the town of Bountiful, just outside Salt Lake City, where Rolf works as the editor for the Davis County Clipper newspaper. Stephen wanted to follow in his father's footsteps and publish some freelance stories in the Clipper before he took a position with the Salt Lake Tribune's digital advertising division. While Stephen liked the job itself, he did not like the fact that it required him to work overnight hours, so he wound up taking a new advertising position with the website Matchbin.com. Stephen was also not too fond of the cold winter weather of Salt Lake City, so in April of 2009, he decided to move to St. George, which was located 300 miles away in the southernmost section of Utah near the Nevada and Arizona borders. He would rent a room at a house which he shared with another tenant named Jordan Zirkel, but the two roommates couldn't have had more opposite personalities. While Stephen was very devoted to his church and his faith, Jordan liked to drink and smoke weed and had a prior conviction on his record for possession of a controlled substance, but while they did not become close friends, they were able to maintain an amicable relationship. Upon his arrival in St. George, Stephen became a member of the Bloomington Hills 7th Ward, a local singles ward. While Stephen's siblings had gotten married and had children by this point, he continued to remain single, as he had once broken off a serious relationship with a woman who did not hold the same interest in the LDS Church that he did. Unfortunately for Stephen, 1 month after he moved to St. George, he would be laid off from his job at Matchbin.com. Since the United States was in the midst of the Great Recession, and the job market in St. George was scarce, Stephen had trouble finding steady employment, though he did manage to get a part-time job handing out flyers for a business called Travis's Window and Blind Cleaning. However, this job did not provide Stephen with enough income to pay his bills, and by the end of November, Jordan Zirkel had moved out of their house, and Stephen was now 3 months and $1,500 behind in his rent. In spite of his financial difficulties, Stephen was reluctant to accept assistance from his family, as a check which was sent to him by his grandmother was never cashed. On December the 9th, Rolf Kocher received a phone call from Brett Bishop, who was Stephen's landlord. Bishop said that he had been unable to get a hold of Stephen and was calling Rolf because he was listed as a reference on his rental agreement. Bishop let Rolf know that Stephen was way behind with paying his rent, which prompted Rolf to call Stephen on his cell phone while he was out grocery shopping. Rolf told his son that he was willing to offer financial support, but Stephen seemed offended by the suggestion and abruptly hung up. The following day, Stephen sent his father a text which read, quote, "Hi Dad, I'm okay." At 6:56 Mountain Time, Stephen received a call on his cell phone from his mother Deanne and told her that he was planning to come home to visit their family in Bountiful for Christmas and would likely be arriving on December the 23rd. To assist him with his financial issues, Deanne also transferred some money to her son's bank account, but it was never touched. That same day, Stephen also received a phone call from his sister, and both she and Deanne would describe Stephen as sounding like he was in an upbeat mood. But they were both completely unaware that Stephen had taken both of these calls while in the midst of a lengthy road trip. Before I start talking about this trip, I just wanted to clarify that the locations in Utah are Mountain Time, and the locations in Nevada are Pacific Time, which has a 1 hour difference, so I'll try to specify which time zone he was in whenever I mention them. At some point during the late evening of December the 9th, or the early morning hours of December the 10th, Stephen left St. George in his white 2003 Chevrolet Cavalier, and debit card records would later show that he traveled 300 miles to Salt Lake City and purchased gas there at 6:45 a.m. Mountain Time. He soon crossed the state line into Nevada and proceeded to purchase gas in the town of West Wendover, 125 miles away. After that, Stephen traveled another 115 miles to the unincorporated community of Ruby Valley, where at 11 a.m. Pacific time, he stopped at a ranch owned by a couple named John and Kathy Neff. Years earlier, while Stephen was a member of a Salt Lake City LDS singles ward, he became acquainted with their daughter, Anne Marie Neff, and while they dated for a period, they never developed a serious relationship. Stephen wanted to see Anne Marie, but she was not there at the time, but her parents still invited him inside for lunch. During their conversation, Stephen mentioned that he was planning to visit friends or family members in Sacramento, California, but he wasn't sure if he would continue in that direction because of bad weather. This remark would later strike Stephen's loved ones as odd, because as far as they knew, Stephen did not have family or friends in Sacramento. After leaving the ranch, Stephen headed back into Utah, and debit transactions showed that he purchased food at a convenience store in Salt Lake City, fuel in Springville, and food in Nephi. During the afternoon and early evening, Stephen received the aforementioned calls on his cell phone from his sister and mother, but he never mentioned that he was driving through the state at that time. By the time he arrived back in St. George, Stephen had driven a total of nearly 1,100 miles. On December the 11th, Stephen spent the day handing out some more flyers for the window washing business and also had a meeting with the bishop of the Bloomington Hills 7th Ward, who promised that he would help Stephen find a job by the new year and would later say that Stephen seemed to be in another positive mood. On December the 12th, Stephen left St. George on another unexplained road trip to Nevada, and at 8:19 a.m. Pacific time, his cell phone would ping off a tower near Overton, about 80 miles away. Nearly 8 hours later, Stephen used his debit card to purchase gas in Mesquite, Nevada, which is located at the approximate halfway point between Overton and St. George. Shortly before 8 p.m. Mountain Time, Stephen stopped at a Kmart just outside St. George, where he purchased a baby's bib, little ornaments, and decorated cookies, which were likely going to be Christmas presents for his older brother Matthew and his newborn baby, as he had drawn their names in the family's annual Christmas gift exchange. One of Stephen's neighbors would report that he saw Stephen's car parked outside his house at around 10 p.m. Mountain Time, but when he looked back a half hour later, the car was gone, and it's unclear if Stephen ever returned and spent the night there. The next confirmed sighting of Stephen took place at 7:52 a.m. Pacific time on the morning of December the 13th, which was a Sunday. Stephen received a phone call on his cell phone from Greg Webb, who was the president of the LDS Singles Ward, and told Stephen that he was driving back to St. George from Las Vegas and would be performing that morning service. The service was scheduled to begin at 11 a.m. Mountain Time, but Webb wasn't sure if he would make it back in time and asked if Stephen would take over in his absence. To Webb's surprise, Stephen said that he was currently in the Las Vegas area, and while he said he was willing to head back to St. George to do the service, Webb told him not to worry about it. At 9:53 a.m. Pacific time, Stephen received another phone call on his cell from a member of his ward, who also heard Stephen say he was in Las Vegas. Neither caller noticed anything unusual about Stephen during their conversations, but he never told them why he decided to travel to Vegas, as it was uncommon for him to miss Sunday services. For the next 4 days, no one heard from Stephen, but on December the 17th, Deanne Kocher found a surprising voicemail from the parking authority for a homeowners association called Sun City Anthem, an affluent retirement community located in Henderson, Nevada, just outside Las Vegas. Even though Henderson is around 135 miles away from St. George, Deanne learned that Stephen's abandoned Chevrolet Cavalier had been found in the cul-de-sac of a residential neighborhood in Sun City Anthem. The homeowners association noticed that the vehicle had been parked there for days, and when they looked in through the window, they saw a flyer for Travis's window and blind cleaning, so they called the phone number on it. This led to them receiving Stephen's cell phone number, and they proceeded to leave a voicemail for him about his car, but when they were unable to get in touch with him, they called Deanne. Deanne soon learned that no one else had spoken to or heard from Stephen in days, so she became concerned enough to contact the St. George Police Department and file a missing persons report for him. Rolf Kocher and two of Steven's brothers traveled to St. George to check out his house and discovered that most of his clothing and personal possessions were still there. He'd also left behind his laptop, cell phone charger, and passport, and since there were recently purchased groceries at the residence, nothing suggested that Steven had planned to take off voluntarily. A search of Steven's laptop and email account would not turn up anything unusual or shed any light on why he decided to travel to Henderson. However, it's worth noting that since Steven's residence did not have an internet connection, he used computers at the Washington County Library in order to go online. While their system required Steven to sign in using his library card, he did not keep track of any of the websites that Steven visited. Rolf and his sons traveled to Henderson to pick up Steven's car and discovered that it was in good working order and had half a tank of gas. Items left in the car included Steven's shaving kit, coats, a pillow, a blanket, receipts, flyers for the window washing business, copies of job applications, and the Christmas gift Steven had purchased from the Kmart near St. George. Steven's cell phone, wallet, and driver's license were never found, and there would be no further activity on his debit or credit cards. It turned out that one of the residents in Sun City Anthem had a home security camera outside his house, and when investigators checked the footage, they saw Steven's Cavalier driving west through the neighborhood down Savannah Springs Avenue in the direction of the cul-de-sac at 11:54 a.m. Pacific Time on December the 13th. 6 minutes later, a man could be seen walking down the sidewalk past the camera in the opposite direction. Even though the footage was shot from a distance and was not particularly clear, the man was believed to be Steven, and he was dressed in a white shirt and white slacks, and appeared to be carrying something, which may have been a file folder or portfolio. It's also worth noting that before Steven walked past the camera, a white SUV could be seen driving down the street, and after Steven disappeared from the frame, the SUV suddenly reappeared and pulled up to the curb next to a house. However, it's worth noting that the driver of the SUV turned out to be a realtor who was ruled out as having any connection to Steven's case. It also turned out that another security camera, mounted on a garage on the adjacent Evening Light Street, captured a reflection of Steven in the windows of a parked minivan, and he could be seen crossing the street and disappearing out of frame. No one could figure out why Steven would have traveled to Henderson to begin with, and if he went there seeking some sort of employment opportunity, there was no evidence found to indicate this. There was even speculation that due to his financial difficulties, Steven may have become desperate enough to perform illegal activities such as trafficking drugs. But police performed a thorough search of Steven's car with a drug-sniffing dog, which did not turn up any hits and seemed to rule out the possibility that drugs were ever in the vehicle. When investigators checked Steven's phone records, they did not provide any additional insight into why he went to Henderson, as everyone he spoke to during his incoming and outgoing calls was accounted for. But it turned out that at around 4:36 p.m. on December the 13th, over 4.5 hours after Steven parked his car in Sun City Anthem, his cell phone pinged off a tower at an intersection of Arroyo Grande Boulevard and American Pacific Drive, a spot which was located over 10 miles northeast. Just over 2 hours later, it pinged off another tower 2 miles north of that near the Whitney Ranch subdivision. Early the next morning, there was another ping off a cell tower at the interchange between Interstate 515 and Russell Road, which was an additional 2 miles from the previous ping. Steven's phone pinged off a tower near that same location at 6:04 a.m. Pacific Time, and most curiously, the phone was then used to check Steven's voicemail, though it's unclear if Steven himself did this. As far as anyone could tell, the phone remained in that vicinity for the next 2 days before its signal was lost, likely because the battery went dead. While an extensive search effort was performed at the desert area surrounding Henderson, it turned up no trace of Steven. Since Steven had promised his family that he would return home to Bountiful on December the 23rd in order to spend Christmas with them, they held out hope that he might show up that day, but he never did, making it a very sad holiday season for them. The coaches would perform numerous searches through the Las Vegas area and offered a $10,000 reward for information, which led to Steven being found. One of Steven's cousins had a friend who worked for Anderson Dairy, and they agreed to have Steven's photo and personal information circulated on their milk cartons. In January of 2010, the coaches responded to reports that a homeless-looking man matching Steven's description had been seen frequenting an IHOP restaurant on Boulder Highway several times over the past 3 weeks. The family spent 4 nights hanging around the IHOP, hoping that this man might stop by again, but he never did, though the coaches ultimately concluded that the man was probably not Steven, since he was described as being shorter and displaying some unusual habits at the restaurant, such as wrapping his seat in saran wrap before eating with plastic gloves on. At one point, a private investigator working for the Kocher family received an anonymous tip advising him to search the desert area near Henderson Executive Airport, but even though an organized search effort would turn up an abandoned tent containing clothing and trash and some bones, these bones actually belonged to an animal and no trace of Steven could be found. When the 1-year anniversary of Steven's disappearance arrived, his family made a vow to keep the lights on their Christmas tree lit until Steven returned home, and the lights remained on until they burned out in July of 2011. The Investigation Discovery True Crime series Disappeared agreed to produce an episode about Steven's case, and it would contain interviews with his parents, Rolf and Deanne. But tragically, on February the 10th, 2011, only 3 weeks after Rolf filmed his interview, he suddenly passed away at the age of 61. Prior to his death, Rolf had suffered through a brief illness and may have died as the result of toxic shock syndrome. The Disappeared episode would air 2 months later on April the 11th and was dedicated to Rolf's memory. Over the next decade, more search efforts would be performed for Steven, but they did not seem to bring the case any closer to a resolution. However, on November the 21st, 2022, while I was in the midst of working on this episode, the Las Vegas-based media outlet 8 News Now produced a segment about Steven's case containing some surprising new information. The segment contained interviews with Kevin Wyatt, James Burke, and Danny Livingston, who all worked for the Utah-based company Eyes-On Private Investigations, as they had spent the past few years interviewing new witnesses and combing through documents about Steven's disappearance at no cost to the Kocher family. And like I mentioned in the intro, the group had produced a long-form podcast about the case in 2021 titled Eyes on Justice. During the 8 News Now segment, Kevin Wyatt stated, quote, "There's not one shred of evidence that suggests that Steven did this to himself or that Steven walked away," end quote. I'll be going into more details about this later on in the episode, but long story short, on the very same afternoon that Steven went missing, a resident who lived on Evening Light Street in Sun City Anthem reported that they saw what appeared to be someone moving out of the house across the street, and they seemed to be doing so rather quickly. When police went to this house and knocked on the door, there was no answer, and when they looked in through the windows, they did not see any furniture in there. It took 2 months for investigators to finally track down and interview the person who had lived there, and while he appeared to be nervous, he claimed he did not know Steven and denied having any knowledge about what happened to him. Well, according to the 8 News Now segment, shortly after Steven parked his car in the cul-de-sac, he apparently spoke to a witness at one of the houses on Savannah Springs Avenue and may have realized he was at the wrong address before he rounded the corner and headed down Evening Light Street. The segment contained this cryptic quote about Steven from Kevin Wyatt, quote, "He says, 'Hey guys, do you want some cash? Something about money.' I think he went to the home he was supposed to go to and actually says, 'Oh, kind of funny. I told the guy and asked him if he wanted some money.' I think that's what resulted in Steven's disappearance, was that error," end quote. The implication seems to be that due to his financial issues, Steven received an offer from someone to travel to Henderson and make a delivery in Sun City Anthem. But because Steven initially went to the wrong address, he inadvertently wound up putting his life at risk, and this led to his disappearance. The news segment also obtained some photographs that the private investigators had obtained of a room located inside the aforementioned house on Evening Light Street. These photos were taken shortly after Steven vanished and show some noticeable damage, including several holes in the walls and doors, which suggests that a violent struggle might have taken place there. However, it's worth noting that the Henderson Police Department declined to be interviewed for the segment, claiming that they had no new updates to provide. They have never named anyone as a suspect or person of interest, or publicly commented on this theory about Steven being a victim of foul play. So the investigation continues to remain at a standstill, and after 13 years, there's still no conclusive answers about what actually happened to Stephen Kocher. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So if you listen to this podcast long enough, I'm sure you're well aware that I've always had a particular fascination with unsolved mysteries where a victim goes missing or winds up dead after traveling to a location they had no reason to be at. This certainly applies here because we have Stephen Kocher making an unexplained 135-mile trip from St. George, Utah to Henderson, Nevada before he exited his vehicle and vanished without a trace. That would be unusual enough on its own, but what makes this case extra bizarre is that Stephen made multiple unexplained road trips in the days prior to his disappearance, including a nearly 1,100-mile round trip through Utah and Nevada, which he drove over the course of just under 24 hours. Why did Stephen decide to make these trips, and did they have any connection to his disappearance? Could these trips be an indication that Stephen might not have been in his right mind at the time? Or did he get himself involved with something that his friends and family did not know about? There have been so many theories pushed forward about Stephen's disappearance, such as him being a victim of foul play, or disappearing to start a new life, or walking off into the Nevada desert to kill himself, but the one theory I haven't even mentioned yet, which I'm 100% convinced is not true, is that Stephen ran away with another missing person from Utah. On December the 7th, 2009, less than 1 week before Stephen vanished, 28-year-old Susan Powell, her husband Josh Powell, and their two sons, 4-year-old Charlie and 2-year-old Braden, were discovered to be missing from their residence in West Valley City, which is 300 miles northwest of St. George. Josh and the two boys returned later that day, and he claimed that he had taken Charlie and Braden out camping. According to Josh, when they left their house, Susan was still sleeping, and he had no idea where she was now, but nobody believed that story. Since the couple had been experiencing marital difficulties, Josh quickly became the prime suspect in his wife's disappearance. Well, the following year, Josh and his family started publicly expressing their belief that Susan disappeared voluntarily and ran off with Stephen Kocher. In fact, Josh's father, Steve Powell, sent law enforcement a 9-page letter outlining the similarities between the two cases and a lot of points which he believed supported the theory that Susan and Stephen had been conducting an affair and orchestrated their disappearance in order to frame Josh for murder. Like Stephen, Susan was a devout Mormon, and Stephen had briefly lived in West Valley City for a few months in 2007, so the Powells suspected that they had taken off to Brazil, since Stephen had previously done missionary work there. While investigators never found any evidence that the two cases were connected, and Stephen's movements and communications in the last week of his life are pretty well documented, so there did not seem to be any opportunity for him to orchestrate a disappearance with Susan. As I'm sure many of you probably know, due to Josh being a suspect in his wife's disappearance, Susan's parents eventually got custody of Braden and Charlie, and Josh was only allowed supervised visitations. And on February the 5th, 2012, when the two boys showed up for a scheduled visitation at Josh's house, he locked their social worker outside and proceeded to attack Braden and Charlie with a hatchet before setting off an explosion which killed both himself and his children in a murder-suicide. Virtually everyone believes that Josh murdered Susan and disposed of her body in a desert area during the time period he said he was camping, but she has still not been found to this day. Steve Powell died of a heart attack in 2018, and since he was always suspected of being complicit in Susan's disappearance, it's believed that he attempted to exploit the disappearance of another Utah resident, which happened to take place 1 week later, in order to deflect suspicion away from himself and his son. But like I just mentioned, West Valley City and St. George are located 300 miles apart, and since there's nothing to suggest that Stephen and Susan ever met each other, I think the timing of their disappearances is nothing more than a coincidence. So we can definitely move away from this theory. Anyway, if you go to newspapers.com and check the religious section of the February 19th, 1999 edition of the Davis County Clipper, which is where Rolf Kocher worked as an editor, you'll find a full page outlining recent news about LDS church missionaries and announces that Stephen, listed here as Elder Kocher, have been called upon to serve in the Brazil, Sao Paulo, East Mission. I always find it haunting when I see the names of missing and murdered people listed in older news articles which were published long before they became a victim. At that particular point in his life, Stephen had recently graduated high school and seemed to have a bright future ahead of him, and he probably never would have guessed that just over 10 years later, he would be single, childless, broke, underemployed, and wind up going missing. Mormonism is a religion which puts a lot of focus on getting married and starting a family, and unlike his siblings, Stephen had not done that yet, even though he had just turned 30. For this reason, I've seen a lot of speculation and online discussions about this case that Stephen may have been a closeted gay man and made a trip to Henderson for some sort of secret hookup, but there's no evidence to support this theory at all. We do know that Stephen once had a fairly serious relationship with a woman which wound up ending before they could become engaged, but I'd be curious to know more about his relationship with Anne-Marie Neff, as Stephen took a lengthy trip to her family's ranch 3 days before he vanished. All we know is that Stephen first met her as part of an activity for his LDS singles ward, but even though they dated, and Stephen seemed to really enjoy Anne-Marie's company, the relationship never developed into anything serious. So it really makes me wonder why he felt inclined to drive 360 miles to Ruby Valley, Nevada, in order to show up at her family's ranch unannounced. We'll talk more about this whole road trip momentarily, but I've always wondered, was Stephen hoping to rekindle his romance with Anne-Marie and drove up there for the express purpose of seeing her? Or did Stephen make this lengthy trip for completely different reasons and only decided to pay the Neff family a visit because he just happened to be in the area? In addition to the social pressures of starting a family, it definitely sounds like Stephen was facing huge pressure to find steady employment and a steady income. Obviously, since this was only 1 year removed from the Great Recession, Stephen was far from the only person in America who was facing these struggles, but given how unwilling he seemed to accept financial assistance from his family, you get the sense that he may have felt like a failure. And while he supposedly did not show any outward signs of being suicidal, Stephen's struggles could have given him a potential motivation to end his own life. Yes, it doesn't make much sense for him to drive 135 miles to another state in order to kill himself, but we've seen examples like the Gail Delano case from Unsolved Mysteries, where suicidal people will do that very thing. So if Stephen decided to wander out into the Nevada desert, perhaps his body has just never been found. In spite of his precarious position, Stephen was also described as having no obvious signs of depression, but I find it interesting how 8 months before he vanished, he made the decision to relocate from Salt Lake City to St. George, apparently because he could not stand the cold Salt Lake City winters. This took him 300 miles away from his family, so I have to wonder if there might be more to this decision. Perhaps he was suffering from an undiagnosed case of seasonal affective disorder, which causes depression to hit during the fall and winter months before it subsides in the spring and summer months. If Stephen found himself feeling very down during the cold Salt Lake City winters, that would shed some light on his decision to move south to a city located near the Nevada and Arizona borders, which had a much warmer climate. But I think it was just Stephen's bad luck that he was laid off only 1 month after his relocation, and he was now residing in a city where the job market was poor, and he likely had too much pride to move back home. You could assume that Stephen may have decided to move so far away from his family because he felt trapped in an oppressive religion, but it sounds like Stephen took his faith very seriously, which is why he remained heavily involved in LDS activities in St. George. I really do get the impression that Stephen was close with his family, and during their interviews on the Disappeared episode, Rolf and Deanna Kocher come across as loving parents and genuinely nice people, which is why I've always found it hard to believe that Stephen disappeared voluntarily. It's really heartbreaking to see Rolf get emotional and cry a few times during his Disappeared episode, knowing that he would pass away only a few weeks after his interview was filmed, and he would already be deceased by the time the episode aired. I think the fact that Stephen did not even resurface following the death of his father is a pretty strong indicator that he's no longer with us, unfortunately. Due to Stephen's financial issues, the most logical theory for his trip to Henderson is that he was seeking some sort of employment opportunity, or at the very least, something that could earn him money. But even if that were the case, That doesn't explain why Stephen made those two other unexplained road trips through Nevada on December the 10th and 12th. According to Deanne, this sort of thing wasn't all that unusual for Stephen, as one of the reasons he moved to St. George was to research family history in the area, and he often went on tours of cemeteries looking for ancestors' graves. Stephen was known for being a spontaneous person, so Deanne theorized that her son could have made these trips in order to keep himself busy while he was underemployed. Well, I can understand the logic in that, but the problem is that these road trips can be expensive, as Stephen had to stop and pay for gas multiple times, even though he was pretty much broke and 3 months behind on his rent. I guess one possible explanation is that if Stephen was feeling suicidal and had already made plans to end his own life, he could have decided to spend his last days driving around in order to see some sights with little consideration of how it would affect his finances. But the main hole in that theory is that Stephen purchased Christmas gifts for his brother and newborn child, which suggested that at the very least, he was planning to visit his family for the holidays. However, let's look at the timeline for Stephen's road trip on the 10th, which is very odd. His first transaction was purchasing gas in Salt Lake City at 6:45 a.m. Mountain Time, which is nearly a 4.5-hour drive from St. George. This means the latest that Stephen could have left his home was shortly after 2 a.m., meaning that he would have completed an 1,100-mile drive on little, if any, sleep, and the timeline throughout the day doesn't give much opportunity for him to pull over and take a nap. So could this mean that Stephen was not in his right mind at the time? You also have to wonder if there's a specific reason he traveled to Salt Lake City, because he then drove west from there to the Neff's Ranch in Ruby Valley. If that was the primary purpose of his trip, why not just drive straight from St. George to Ruby Valley, as making that detour to Salt Lake City added an extra few hours to his journey? I mentioned earlier that if Stephen really wanted to see Anne-Marie, why not call ahead to make sure she would be there that day before making the drive? So it makes you wonder if Stephen had another reason for traveling to the Ruby Valley area, and he made a spontaneous decision to visit the ranch because he just happened to be there. Another odd detail is that Stephen told the Neffs that he was planning to travel to Sacramento to visit family and friends, even though it does not sound like he knew anyone there. Since it takes around 7.5 hours to drive from Ruby Valley to Sacramento, there's no way that Stephen could have gone there that day, so why did he bring it up? And once again, after leaving Ruby Valley, I'm not sure why Stephen took a winding route and drove back to Salt Lake City, because if he had just traveled southeast directly to St. George, he would have arrived home a lot quicker. It sounds like December the 11th was a routine day for Stephen, but his road trip through Nevada on the 12th has a lot more gaps in the timeline, and since there were no eyewitnesses who reported interacting with Stephen that day, we have no idea what he was doing. We only know that his cell phone pinged off a tower near Overton at 8:19 a.m. Pacific Time, and he purchased gas in Mesquite at 4:04 p.m. Pacific Time, but those places are only about 40 miles apart, so where was Stephen during that nearly 8-hour gap? He probably wasn't driving that entire time, because otherwise, he probably would have needed to stop for fuel more than once. His purchases at the Kmart near St. George took place at 7:58 p.m. Mountain Time, even though driving there from Mesquite would only take about 45 minutes. So we have another gap of time in which Stephen's whereabouts are unaccounted for, and you have to wonder if this influenced his decision to travel to Henderson. I have to say, these trips are giving me flashbacks to the unsolved 1994 disappearance of 23-year-old Karen Denise Wells, which I covered on episode number 106 of The Trail Went Cold. Denise left her hometown in Oklahoma on a cross-country road trip to visit a friend in New Jersey, but she wound up going missing, and her abandoned rental car was discovered in rural Pennsylvania. A check of Denise's known movements, as well as the odometer on the vehicle, showed that she inexplicably drove an additional 700 miles on her trip, which were never accounted for, so it's been speculated that she may have become involved in drug trafficking, and this caused her disappearance. Not surprisingly, it's been theorized that Stephen's lengthy road trips may also have been connected to drug trafficking. Even though he was known for being a morally upstanding individual and an unlikely candidate to participate in anything illegal, due to his desperate financial situation, could he have been roped into doing something he ordinarily wouldn't have? What makes the trip to Henderson even more murky is that we have the account from Stephen's neighbor that he saw his car parked outside his residence in St. George at around 10 p.m. on December the 12th, but it was gone a half hour later. The next confirmed sighting of Stephen is when he spoke to Greg Webb on the phone the following morning at 7:52 a.m. Pacific Time and said he was in the Las Vegas area. So after his neighbor noticed the missing car at 10:30 p.m. Mountain Time the previous evening, did Stephen return to his residence before he drove to Vegas? Or did Stephen spend the night at an altogether different location? The fact that a blanket and a pillow were found inside the abandoned Cavalier suggests that he may have slept there. Okay, so when Stephen arrived in the Sun City Anthem neighborhood in Henderson, he was last seen passing by the security camera exactly at noon, which means that he may have had an appointment at one of the houses at a specific time. But here's the big issue with that. When Greg Webb called Stephen, he told him that he might not make it back in time for the Singles Ward's morning service and asked Stephen to fill in for him. Even though Stephen said he was in Vegas, he told Webb that he would be willing to return to St. George to do the service until Webb told him not to bother. So if Stephen had a scheduled appointment in Henderson that day, why would he offer to go back home? Even though there's no indication that Stephen was a gambler, I guess he could have become desperate enough to travel to Vegas and attempt to win some money. I'm not sure if law enforcement ever attempted to check the security footage at any of the casinos to see if Stephen ever showed up to one. That still doesn't explain why he went to Henderson, and we don't know anything about Stephen's possible movements in the Vegas area that morning. Now, even though it's generally accepted that Stephen was the man captured walking down the sidewalk in Sun City Anthem, I have to acknowledge that the footage is blurry and shot from such a long distance away that you really can't tell with 100% certainty that it's him. I know that Stephen's family have studied the footage and are pretty sure it's him due to the way he walks and his body language, but theoretically, could something have happened to Stephen beforehand and another man decided to abandon his car in the neighborhood and walk away from the scene? Well, Occam's razor tells me that it is Stephen, as the consensus from the private investigators working on this case is that something bad happened to him only minutes after he walked past that camera and he never left the neighborhood alive. Of course, even though there are no more confirmed sightings of Stephen, his cell phone pinged off various towers located outside the neighborhood in the days following his disappearance. And someone checked the phone's voicemail 2 days after the fact, even though there's nothing to indicate that Stephen was still alive at this point. So if Stephen was dead, either the perpetrator kept his phone in their possession, or the phone was kept alongside Stephen's body, and these pings might provide a clue to the area where he's buried. While we're on the subject of Stephen's cell phone, all of the callers on his phone records have been accounted for and offer no insight into why he would have traveled to Henderson. Stephen's laptop and email account also turned up no leads, but it's worth reiterating that all of his internet activity would have taken place on computers at the library. So if Stephen had a meetup or an appointment for an employment opportunity scheduled in Henderson, perhaps all his communication was done on the library's computers through websites like Craigslist. But perhaps there is no digital or paper trail to explain Stephen's trip, and any possible arrangements were made verbally. And I think now would be a good time to discuss Stephen's landlord, Brett Bishop. Even though Stephen was renting a house in St. George, Brett Bishop and his wife Tina lived in Orem, Utah, which is located about 265 miles northwest. Brett is actually quite a sketchy character, as he had an arrest record, and in August of 2009, the authorities performed a raid of his residence in Orem, where they turned up a cache of guns, some marijuana, a number of prescription pills and prescription bottles with other people's names on them, and a porch which had been stolen from a dealership in Arizona years earlier. Brett had previously been employed by a closed-door pharmacy business, which would deliver prescription medications to exclusive clients, such as rest homes and troubled youth centers. The reason the pharmacy let Brett go was because they received an anonymous email alleging that he might have been ripping them off in order to sell these pills on the side. I mentioned in the intro that a YouTuber named Aaron Stoner, ironic name given what we're talking about right now, has done a thorough, multi-episode series about this case, and one of his episodes focused on online posts that Tina Bishop made in places like the Web Sleuths Forum in the years following Stephen's disappearance. During her posts, Tina has cast a lot of suspicion on Jordan Zirkel, Stephen's former roommate at the house in St. George. As you recall, Stephen and Jordan had polar opposite personalities, as Stephen was a straight-laced religious person who was very devoted to his faith, while Jordan seemed to be more of a partier who had a prior drug possession conviction on his record, though it sounds like they got along well enough and did not have any serious conflict. Even though I'm not sure Tina ever met Jordan, it almost seems like she's trying to portray him as this major drug dealer who could have gotten Stephen involved in something illegal, but the problem is that Jordan moved out of the house a month before Stephen went missing, and there's nothing to indicate that the two roommates were still keeping in touch. Jordan even agreed to do a phone interview on one of Aaron Stoner's YouTube episodes, and he honestly sounds like he has nothing to hide. Jordan was very cooperative when he was interviewed by law enforcement during the original investigation, and it does not sound like they ever considered him to be a possible suspect. So it's been theorized that Tina may have been pointing the finger at Jordan in order to deflect suspicion away from her husband, Brett. One interesting detail Jordan shared during his interview is that whenever Brett visited the residence in St. George, he was always carrying a toilet bag which made noises whenever it moved to indicate that it likely contained a bunch of pill bottles. Now here's where things get weird. At the time he went missing, Stephen was 3 months and $1,500 behind in his rent, but when Brett was interviewed by police following his disappearance, he said that he had no plans to evict Stephen from the house since he was confident the money would be eventually paid. During your online posts, Stephen stated that a few days before Stephen went missing, Brett had spoken to him and they quote-unquote worked something out, which would ensure that the rent would be all paid up by January. But the problem is that Stephen's phone records were checked, and while it shows that Brett texted him a few times on December the 7th and the 8th, there's no record of any communication between them until December the 13th, when Brett called Stephen's phone at 4:36 p.m. that afternoon. This was 4.5 hours after Stephen was last seen in Sun City Anthem, and explains why his phone pinged off a tower located about 10 miles away. Let's also not forget that Brett made a phone call to Rolf Kocher on December the 9th to inform him about the rent situation, as Stephen had listed him as a reference on his rental agreement. Brett told Rolf that he had called him because he was unable to reach Stephen, but it still strikes me as odd that he would phone the father of a 30-year-old man about the situation, as if he was a teacher calling the parents of a student who was having trouble in school. If Stephen and Brett had already, quote-unquote, worked something out, why would he feel the need to call Rolf to begin with? According to Rolf, Stephen acted pretty hostile when he called to inquire about the situation, so it sounds like Stephen was none too pleased that Brett got in touch with his father. But here's the really interesting part. During his lengthy road trip on December the 10th, Stephen stopped to get gas in Springville, Utah at 5:25 p.m. Mountain Time, which would have been on his route between Salt Lake City and St. George. Well, I previously revealed that Brett and Tina Bishop lived in Orem, and it just happens to be located 14 miles outside of Springville. So could Stephen have paid a visit to the Bishops that day, and this is where they worked something out? If Brett was involved in drug trafficking, could he have coerced Stephen into making some deliveries for him in exchange for wiping out the debt of Stephen's back rent? Given Stephen's character, I don't want to accuse him of getting involved in something illegal without evidence, but it's also possible that Brett asked Stephen to do some favors for him without revealing the full extent of what it was. I mentioned earlier that it made no sense for Stephen to drive northeast through Utah towards Salt Lake City before he went to visit the Neffs in Ruby Valley, since it would have been a much quicker route for him to drive northwest through Nevada. However, if Stephen needed to pay a visit to the Bishops in Orem, that would explain his detour, and for all we know, they could have given him some cash to help cover his expenses, such as his stops to pay for gas. This may also account for Stephen's road trip through Nevada on December the 12th, where he passed through Overton and Mesquite, as he may have been asked to make some deliveries there. If Brett roped Stephen into doing something for him, I have to wonder if his call to Rolf was a psychological ploy of some sort, because now that Stephen knew that his parents were aware of his serious financial problems, he might have felt desperate enough to help Brett out in order to make his unpaid rent issues go away. Now, Tina says that on December the 13th, she and Brett traveled to the house in St. George and discovered that Stephen wasn't there, but noticed that his personal possessions were still inside the residence. But in separate online posts which were made years apart, Tina told two completely different stories. At first, Tina wrote that she and Brett took a routine trip to St. George and decided to stay at the house in order to save money on a hotel, since there was an unused master bedroom which was always kept locked when they weren't there. However, in her second post, Tina claimed that Brett was worried that Stephen might have decided to skip out without paying his rent, so they decided to travel to the house, but since Stephen's personal belongings were still there, this quelled their concern that he had taken off. But once again, phone records showed that Brett made no attempt to call or text Stephen's cell phone between 8:23 a.m. on December the 8th and 4:36 p.m. on December the 13th. If you were so concerned that Stephen was going to take off without paying his rent, why wouldn't you try calling or texting him rather than drive 3.5 hours from Orem to St. George? And when Brett was interviewed by police, he said he was confident that Stephen would pay him everything he owed rather than taking off. It just strikes me as an odd coincidence that Brett and Tina would decide to make this impromptu trip to Stephen's house on the same afternoon he went missing. In addition, the last time Brett called Stephen's cell phone was on December the 14th at 6:04 a.m., which is right around the same time the phone was used to check his voicemail, which seems like another odd coincidence. All that being said, these suspicions about the Bishops are based entirely on Tiffany's online posts, and at no point have law enforcement ever named Brett as a suspect or person of interest. But let's operate under the assumption that Brett asked Stephen to drive to Henderson and make a delivery in the Sun City Anthem neighborhood. From what I can tell, parking on the side of the street in that neighborhood was not permitted for outside residents, so I can see Stephen being given instructions to park in the cul-de-sac at the end of the road in order to avoid attracting attention. When he walked past the security camera, Stephen appeared to be carrying something like a file folder or portfolio, so this very well could have been an item he was attempting to deliver. I just shared a story from Jordan Zirkel about how Brett liked to carry around a toilet bag which likely contained bottles of pills, and since Brett had previously worked for a closed-door pharmacy and had a lot of prescription medication at his residence when the police raided it, I think it's reasonable to assume that Brett may have been stealing pills and selling them on the side. I know that police had a sniffer dog go over Stephen's car, and it found no sign that any drugs had ever been inside the vehicle, but even though sniffer dogs are trained to detect hard drugs like cocaine and heroin, would they really give off much of a reaction if a small bag of prescription medication had been there? It's possible that because Brett had worked for a pharmacy, Stephen may have believed that the deliveries he was making were legit, and he had no idea he was doing anything illegal. Of course, Sun City Anthem would not seem like the most likely location to make a dangerous drug drop, as it's an affluent retirement community where you have to be a minimum age of 55 in order to live there. I know that Brett's closed-door pharmacy delivered medication to rest homes, but how would things escalate to the point that Stephen could make a delivery in Sun City Anthem which put his life at risk? Well, it turned out that at the time, there was one slightly younger resident living in Sun City Anthem who was crashing on his parents' property. Going back to the Aaron Stoner YouTube series, he was able to get a hold of the original police reports for this case and post them on his channel, and they provide insight on the early stages of the investigation. The police did a door-to-door canvass of all the residents of Sun City Anthem, and one of them said that someone appeared to be moving out of a house on Evening Light Street on the same afternoon Stephen went missing, and Stephen just happened to be heading in that direction when he was last seen. It turned out that a couple named Severio and Maria DiMaggio had been living in the house, but moved to another residence in Henderson in November of 2009. This would explain why the house on Evening Light Street seemed to be empty and devoid of furniture whenever the police went to check it out, but it doesn't account for why someone would have been moving out of there on December the 13th. However, Severio and Maria's son, Mark DiMaggio, who was 41 years old at the time, he had been living in a separate guest house on the property, and as far as anyone knew, he was still residing there in December. The police paid multiple visits to the residence and left their business cards, but no one was ever home, and they did not actually track down Mark DiMaggio and interview him until February of 2010. And yes, DiMaggio is the person I referenced earlier in this episode who appeared to be nervous when he was questioned about the case and claimed not to recognize Stephen in any of the photos police showed him. DiMaggio did acknowledge that he moved out of the residence in Sun City Anthem on December the 13th, but for whatever reason, he became very evasive when he was asked where he was currently living, and made remarks about how he didn't like to give out his address because he had no friends in town and, quote-unquote, did not trust anyone due to the drug lifestyle that people tend to have. All he did was provide a P.O. box number in the town of Pahrump, located over 60 miles west, and investigators later learned that DiMaggio owned four properties out there, two of which were vacant lots. Not surprisingly, this has led to speculation from online sleuths that Stephen's remains might be buried on one of these properties. Another odd detail is that in the months following Stephen's disappearance, the police got a number of tips from a woman calling herself Angela, who said there was a guy hanging around Las Vegas Boulevard who resembled Stephen Kocher and was claiming that he was the missing man whose face was being plastered on milk cartons at the time. Investigators looked into this lead, but they never found the man or confirmed that he actually existed. If that wasn't strange enough, one of the original police reports also mentions a tip from an Angela DiMaggio, even though there was no one from the DiMaggio family named Angela. This tipster advised the police to search a particular area of the desert, but nothing was found. I don't believe they ever uncovered Angela's true identity, but it's been suspected that she may have attempted to mislead the investigation and send the police on a wild goose chase in order to give off the false impression that Stephen was still alive somewhere. It's also worth mentioning that DiMaggio agreed to speak with the producers of the aforementioned Eyes on Justice podcast and told them that sometime before Stephen went missing, he had suffered a serious back injury in a car accident and was taking a lot of pain pills, so for this reason, he couldn't remember much about what happened during that time period. A person in that condition sounds like someone who might have been inclined to buy prescription medication on the black market, but DiMaggio denied ever knowing Stephen Kocher or Brett Bishop. Once again, I should reiterate that law enforcement has never publicly commented on DiMaggio or named him as a suspect or person of interest, and no conclusive link has ever been established to prove that DiMaggio and Bishop even knew each other. And if DiMaggio really had a debilitating back injury at that time and was constantly hopped up on pain meds, I question if he would have had the wherewithal to commit a murder and effectively dispose of Stephen's body without leaving any evidence behind. But I have to hearken back to the recent news segment, which featured interviews with the Eyes on Private Investigations team, who seemed pretty certain that Stephen was the victim of foul play, and that something happened to him shortly after he walked past the security camera. It sounds like these private investigators learned that Stephen had gone to a house and briefly spoke to one of the neighborhood's residents about money before he realized he was at the wrong address. It's been theorized that when Stephen finally went to the right address, he joked about how he'd gone to the wrong place and spoke to the wrong person, and for whatever reason, this seemed to sign his death warrant, possibly because the perpetrator was paranoid that Stephen had revealed too much. This person may have concluded that Stephen was a liability, and they had to make him disappear in order to ensure that there was no connection between them. The photographs of extensive damage to walls and doors inside the DiMaggio residence might indicate that Stephen was the victim of a violent struggle in there. But even though the Eyes on Private Investigation team have always been quite open about expressing their personal opinion about what they believe happened to Stephen, the Henderson Police Department have never commented on the situation, and in the recent segment produced by 8 News Now, they simply stated that there were no new updates to provide. So are they remaining silent to protect the integrity of the investigation? Or did they just not put much credence into the private investigator's theory? Did Brett Bishop convince Stephen to travel to Henderson to make some sort of delivery to Mark DiMaggio, which led to him being killed? Well, it is an intriguing theory, but I have to hammer home the point that law enforcement has never publicly commented on Bishop or DiMaggio, and no link has ever been established between the two men. And even if you believe this theory, there's still a ton of unanswered questions. If the purpose of Stephen's road trip on December the 10th was to visit the Bishops in Orem, why did he travel hundreds of more miles west in order to visit the Neffs in Ruby Valley? Why did he tell the Neffs he was planning to visit people in Sacramento? If Stephen had something important scheduled at Henderson, why did he tell Greg Webb he was willing to drive back to St. George to perform the morning service? If he was making a delivery to someone in Henderson, how did they communicate with each other? If Stephen was killed on the same day he went missing, why was someone checking his voicemail 2 days later? I get the sense that a number of people associated with this case now have a pretty good idea what happened to Stephen, but without a body or any hard evidence that a crime even took place, law enforcement is powerless to file any charges or make any arrests. If Stephen was murdered because he was roped into doing something illegal, either knowingly or unknowingly, then you have to feel immense sympathy for him, because it sounds like he was a good man from a fine family who found himself in a desperate financial situation because of a lot of different factors and seemed to have so much pride that he felt he should get out of it on his own. It's possible that there are people out there who might have important information about what happened to Stephen, and the big break this case needs is for the right person to come forward. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Stephen Kocher, you can contact the St. George Police Department, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, or the Henderson Police Department, as they have all worked on this investigation. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. Also, like I mentioned in the intro, our podcast is going to be releasing another Q&A episode near the end of the year, so if you would like to send me any questions to be answered on the show, please email them to me under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Q&A, to robin.warder@icloud.com. The deadline to send in questions is this coming Sunday, December the 11th. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about the murder of Eileen Mangold, a case featured on Unsolved Mysteries which really should have been solved, but wasn't. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the unexplained 1990 death of Chad Maurer. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I have recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Rebecca L., Sarah J., Emily M., Rachel, and Jason T. Thank you all so much for your support. And one more reminder that this coming weekend, we'll also be holding one of our Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch marathons on Saturday, December the 10th, in which we'll be screening classic episodes of Unsolved Mysteries, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. The Live Watch begins at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes or pinned to the top of our social media pages. We hope to see you there. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do that.